it wasn't until after the team let me go that I looked back on all these incidents and said, you know, there's something more to this than the team just cutting an older punter, making room for a newer guy.
As president of the Board of Supervisors, it's my duty to make this announcement.
I have the opportunity to make sure that people understood, look, I am a lesbian. The fact that I have been fighting your fights doesn't mean that I am going to hide what I am.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Russia's Orthodox Church prays for a gay sex ban, America's NFL gets a cluey about equality, and Puerto Rican culture meets New York's Lavender Revolution. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 11th, 2014. Russia may say it's rolling out a global welcome mat for the Sochi Winter Olympics next month, but gay people are clearly not on the guest list. The country's infamous law banning the dissemination of so-called gay propaganda already has some LGBT athletes and prospective spectators on edge, despite the Putin government's repeated assurances that they'll be safe in Sochi. But the country's politically powerful Russian Orthodox Church called this week for the recriminalization of gay sex through a voter referendum. It comes on the heels of a popular Russian actor earlier in the week calling for gays to be put in ovens. According to Agence France-Presse, church spokesman Vsevolod Chaplin told the pro-government Russian-language newspaper Izvestia that it is precisely the majority of our people and not some outside powers that should decide what should be a criminal offense and what should not. The Soviet government criminalized homosexuality in 1934, and Russia repealed the law in 1993 after the breakup of the Soviet Union. But the vast majority of Russians think homosexuality is either an illness or a crime. Gay activist Eduard Mersin told Agence France-Presse that if you stage a referendum in Russia, 90% would back both the death penalty and the idea of shooting all homosexuals. But a prominent member of President Vladimir Putin's political party, Pavel Krasheninnikov, told the Interfax news agency that Parliament would not even consider such a proposal because it would violate the country's international obligations. That's a pre-Olympic statement, of course.
NBC sports anchor Bob Costas says that he's determined to dedicate some airtime during the network's coverage of the Sochi Olympics to discuss Russia's so-called no-promo-homo law. He told the Associated Press that he wanted President Putin to answer for it on the record. And, according to the Huffington Post, Costas told reporters that if Putin doesn't drag his butt into the studio, then we'll talk about it without him.
Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department joined some other Western governments this week to issue travel warnings for their citizens who plan to go to Sochi. It includes a specific recommendation that LGBT travelers should carefully consider the laws and biases of their international destination and decide how open one can be regarding one's sexual orientation or gender identity. The advisory notes that anyone convicted of breaking Russia's law against disseminating gay propaganda could face fines of more than $3,000, up to 14 days in jail, and deportation.
Updating the continuing story in India, the government has asked the Supreme Court to review its December 11th ruling that recriminalized same-gender sex. A two-judge panel of the apex court overturned the 2009 decision by the Delhi High Court that declared the colonial-era Penal Code Section 377, which outlaws intercourse against the order of nature, to be a violation of India's constitution. Some LGBT activists were hoping that the government would take a more aggressive stance and sponsor a repeal measure in Parliament.
The infamous bill to add harsh penalties to already existing laws against homosexual acts in Uganda, including life in prison, still awaits the signature of President Yoweri Museveni. But it's already making life more difficult for HIV/AIDS prevention and treatment workers and their clients. Gay Star News reports that sexual minorities are being viewed as criminals, denied access to antiretroviral drugs, and are going even further underground. One blogger wrote that threats, hateful speeches, and discrimination from religious leaders, politicians, and even biased media are increasing insecurity to peer educators, staff, and the LGBTI community, which is hampering health service delivery. Advocacy groups are warning that it's just a preview of how bad things will get if Museveni signs the bill into law. He has until January 20th to do that, or Parliament can then pass it again without his signature.
In other news, the Chilean Senate approved civil unions legislation for same-gender couples on January 7th. It had been debated on and off in the chamber for the past 2 years. The life partner agreement would allow lesbian and gay couples to certify their unions with the civil registry rather than with a notary. Those couples would be eligible for most of the benefits offered to heterosexual couples except adoption, which is still a dicey issue in many countries. Activists expect the measure to receive final passage by March when current President Sebastián Piñera is succeeded by the newly elected Michelle Bachelet. She said in a recent interview that she would consider endorsing full civil marriage equality. The Senate vote on the civil unions bill was an overwhelming 28 in favor, 6 against, and 2 abstentions. According to the English-language Santiago Times, emotional supporters cheered and evangelical opponents held up banners with biblical messages aimed at lawmakers from the stands of the upper house. The bill goes next to a constitutional committee before returning to Congress later this month. Elsewhere on the continent, Argentina, Uruguay, and Brazil have already opened civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples.
There were further developments this week in the continuing battle over marriage equality in Utah. Some 1,360 same-gender couples married in the U.S. state between December 20th when U.S. District Court Judge Robert Shelby declared Utah's ban on civil marriage for lesbian and gay couples to be unconstitutional, and January 6th when the U.S. Supreme Court approved an emergency stay of the ruling requested by Utah's state government. Republican Governor Gary Herbert said earlier this week that those couples won't be legally recognized by the state until its challenge to the federal judge's ruling is finally resolved, quite possibly in America's highest court. But on January 10th, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced that the federal government will recognize those 1,360 same-gender Utah couples as legally married. He cited the Supreme Court's June 2013 DOMA ruling that legally married lesbian and gay couples are entitled to equal protection and treatment under the law.
I am confirming today that for purposes of federal law, these marriages will be recognized as lawful and considered eligible for all relevant federal benefits on the same terms as other same-sex marriages. These families should not be asked to endure uncertainty regarding their status as the litigation unfolds.
Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union is preparing its own lawsuit to directly challenge Utah's constitutional ban on marriage equality.
In other U.S. marriage equality news, 4 Arizona couples have filed suit in federal court challenging that state's definition of civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Voters added that provision to the Arizona Constitution in 2008. 2 of the plaintiff couples married in California, but Arizona's constitution prevents the state from recognizing those marriages. All 4 couples are longtime residents of the Grand Canyon State. 2 of them are also raising adopted children. Sean Aiken, one of the attorneys representing the couples, told local reporters that the lawsuit points out how unfair Arizona's refusal to recognize out-of-state marriages or allow in-state marriages is, how that affects not just couples, but whole families, and the effect it has on children. Also, hearings are expected to begin in Austin in the coming week in a federal lawsuit challenging the constitutional amendment banning marriage equality in the state of Texas.
And in New Mexico, opponents of marriage equality, established on December 19th by a unanimous state Supreme Court ruling, are pushing a constitutional amendment to overturn that ruling. But an informal survey of New Mexico lawmakers by Albuquerque's KOB-TV revealed that there's not much appetite for this issue in the 30-day legislative session that starts January 21st.
Among some names in the news this week, retired international soccer midfielder Thomas Hitzlsperger came out as a gay man in an interview with the German magazine Die Zeit. The Munich-born footballer has represented the German national team in more than 50 appearances and has played for top-tier clubs in England, Germany, and Italy. He told the magazine that he hopes his coming out will advance the discussion of homosexuality among professional athletes. Response among players and fans to the revelation has been almost universally supportive.
Joseph Lown, who resigned on the eve of winning his fourth term as mayor of the West Texas city of San Angelo in 2009 to live in Mexico with his undocumented gay partner, was legally married to him in a ceremony in Mexico City this week. Lown wed his spouse, who asked not to be identified because he still has relatives living in the United States, with about a dozen family members and friends looking on. The demise of DOMA last June opened the door to the now legally married couple's return to the United States if they so desire.
And finally, comedy icon Lily Tomlin and her creative and life partner of 42 years, Jane Wagner, finally made honest women of each other by marrying on New Year's Eve in New York City. Tomlin and Wagner co-wrote six comedy television specials in which Tomlin starred. They also co-wrote and produced Tomlin's one-woman show, The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, the Grammy Award-winning album, Edith Ann and That's the Truth, and Grammy-nominated albums, Modern Scream and On Stage. Tomlin said that the U.S. Supreme Court's rulings in June that overturned DOMA and ended the Proposition 8 ban on civil marriage equality in California got her and Wagner thinking about making things legal. She told E! Online that, "Everybody I know who got married, they say it really makes a difference. They feel very, very happy about it. You don't really need to get married," she added, "but marriage is awfully nice."
And that's the truth.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 11th, 2014. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced this week by Wenzel Jones and Steve Pride.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
A U.S. National Football League veteran has been making news by scoring touchdowns for LGBT rights. He's double-teamed for this interview by Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones.
Our next guest first came to our attention in 2012 when he gave a Maryland state delegate a very colorful and wonderful schooling in free speech and LGBT rights that went viral. That's also where we learned that he was not only a great football player, but a pretty darn entertaining writer. Shortly after that, NFL punter Chris Cluey lost his position with the Minnesota Vikings.
And on Thursday, Cluey published a letter on Deadspin.com entitled, "I was an NFL player until I was fired by two cowards and a bigot."
For our listeners who don't quite know the whole story, I don't know if you can briefly sort of tell us.
It started during the off-season of my last year with the Vikings when I got contacted by a group called Minnesotans for Marriage Equality that was wondering if I was interested in helping defeat the marriage amendment in Minnesota, which would have banned same-sex marriage. And I said, yeah, that seems like a worthwhile cause, and it's something worth speaking out on. So I contacted the Vikings legal department, you know, made sure that everything I was doing would be okay with the team. They said, yeah, it's fine. As long as you make it clear you're acting as a private citizen and not as Chris Cluey speaking for the Vikings, and which I felt was fair. And so I started speaking out on the issue. And, you know, the momentum started rolling and rolling. And at the same time, there were some incidents going on within the team that were making me feel a little uncomfortable. Some interactions with my special teams coach and then some things that the head coach said about me not being able to speak out. And it wasn't until after the team let me go that I looked back on all these incidents and said, you know, there's something more to this than the team just cutting an older punter, making room for a newer guy. Because that entire year, I'd been doing everything the coaches wanted. My numbers were exactly the same as they had always been, and I still had a year left on my contract. And I had no indication that the Vikings were going to cut me. No one had ever said they were displeased with my performance or that I was punting poorly. So it was a story that I knew I wanted to tell at some point, and I wrote it all down and put it away for safekeeping until I knew I wanted to tell it. And I just put it on Deadspin last week.
And you're telling it now and getting a lot of attention for it. And you've got dates and times and quotes and everything else, and I can't help but wonder if you're sort of preparing yourself for a legal challenge.
I knew that if I wanted to tell the story, then everything I said, you know, had to be factually accurate and it had to be able to be backed up, because otherwise this is the easiest defamation of character lawsuit in the history of the United States. I mean, you can't attack someone's character like that unless it's true, unless it is something that they said, and unless there are witnesses to your events that are willing to back you up. Since the Vikings have said they're going to do an independent investigation and, you know, the people they've hired look trustworthy and they've done stuff like this in the past, a very important thing for me is ensuring that my witness's anonymity remains intact, because being blacklisted in the NFL is a very real possibility, and that's something that I absolutely do not want to happen to my friends and former teammates. And so, you know, this is something that I'm going to insist on, is the fact that I'll give you names, dates, whatever, but, you know, you have to protect these people.
You know, I noticed that you've been very, very respectful of your teammates. You talk a lot about how they've actually been quite supportive.
Yeah, I've never had any problems with my teammates. You know, these are guys I played with out on the field, shared a locker room with. You know, during the season, we see each other more than we see our own families. So it's, you know, you get to know those guys pretty well. And it's something that was also behind the timing of this, was this wasn't something I wanted to drop on the team during the start or the middle of the season, because this would definitely have been a distraction to the team, and it would have impacted their chances of winning games. And again, that's not something I want to do to former teammates.
How is your family doing with this? Because it's one thing to be, you know, related to a football player, but now you're so well known well outside of the world of football.
My wife kind of rolls her eyes at me. She's not a big fan of, you know, of the, like having to do interviews and stuff like that. But at the same time, she understands, you know, it's definitely for a worthwhile cause, and it's for speaking out on human rights and treating people the right way. So she puts up with my shenanigans. Other than that, my daughters are too young to really understand what's going on.
The investigation's happening. What are you hoping that the outcome of this is?
Well, obviously that I'm vindicated, and the investigators find that, yes, all of this did happen, and it was, you know, how Chris described it. And then ultimately, I'd like to see this used as an example of, you know, hey, this didn't just happen to me. This happens to people across the United States day in and day out. And this is a problem that we have to deal with as a society. This is a problem we have to address. And you know, how are we going to go about changing things so that stuff like this doesn't happen in the future?
Former Minnesota Vikings punter Chris Cluey spoke with Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones.
Hi, I'm Cleve Jones, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. An informed community is a strong community.
Prepare your palate for the spicy Puerto Rican portion of the LGBT movement's menu later in the program.
See the way he walks down the street. That's the way he shuffles his feet. What if they were talking about when he goes walking by? He's my guy.
A recent move by the U.S. Postal Service gets Queer Life and Literature commentator Janet Mason's stamp of approval.
Now that Harvey Milk is on the stamp, I'll be able to ask her him by name whenever I go to the post office. The announcement was made close to the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Harvey Milk, who became the first openly gay official to hold public office when he was elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in 1977. The Harvey Milk stamp, which will be issued in 2014, is being heralded as perhaps depicting the first openly gay LGBT figure. However, Harvey Milk is not the first. One notable exception was James Baldwin. Baldwin was perhaps ambiguously out, but he was the author of Giovanni's Room, one of the first gay novels. He is known for his identity as an African-American writer, as a gay writer, and as a great literary figure in general. When a stamp was issued in 2004, my partner, now a retired postal worker, came home with stories about a coworker who asked her if Baldwin was indeed that way, a customer who said he would take any other stamp other than the one with Baldwin's face on it, and another who said he was a great man, I had the honor of meeting him once. My partner's response to hearing that Harvey Milk was going to be on the stamp was one of wonder. Wow, that's deep. I wonder what people will have to say about that. Undoubtedly, some will be thrilled, others repulsed, and unfortunately a great many will be indifferent. Harvey Milk is a great American hero. I was in high school when he was elected to public office, and he is someone who influenced my life greatly. The fact that Anita Bryant, the former Miss Oklahoma, who was best known perhaps as an outspoken opponent of homosexuality, was on the national news denouncing Harvey Milk meant that there were others like me out there. Before the movie Milk, the box office hit starring Sean Penn in 2008, there was a documentary called The Times of Harvey Milk that I saw when it first came out in 1984. I had a ticket for the premiere showing at the Roxy Movie Theater on Samsung Street in Philadelphia. I was 25 and had come out a few years before. Inside this small but cozy theater, the audience was comprised mainly of gay men, with a few pockets of lesbians here and there. The Times of Harvey Milk opened with Dianne Feinstein as the first female president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, announcing that,
"As president of the Board of Supervisors, it's my duty to make this announcement. Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed."
As the documentary progressed, with the narration of Harvey Firestein, the delightfully husky-voiced gay icon, and one of the few openly gay actors at the time, I became aware of an unusual sound coming from all around me. I realized then that it was the sound of men sitting in the dark, softly crying. In those days, my activist life was divided into two camps: women's liberation, which is where most of the lesbians were, and the gay movement, at that time still predominantly men. Often I was the person who brought the two groups together in my activist community. Today, gay men and lesbians are working together, and we are a force to be reckoned with. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
LGBT Puerto Ricans have been on the front lines of key public issues in New York City since Stonewall, all the while fighting for respect from both the LGBT community and from other Latinos. Correspondent Kelly Cogswell asked three prominent out LGBT Puerto Ricans about their activist lives.
Margarita Lopez started early. At 15, she fought U.S. recruiters grabbing her friends for Vietnam. Later, she worked with poor women, then black Puerto Ricans struggling to save their homes. She also helped start the island's first LGBT group, Comité de Orgullo Gay. Those early activist years had a price, and in 1978 she was forced to leave the island where she was born.
I was beat up three times in Puerto Rico on the street. I was not demonstrating, I was not talking to nobody. I was just walking on the street, and because the way I look, you know, these people felt offended. Then I also couldn't find a job. In Puerto Rico at that time, in order for you to get a job, any job, you needed to get a letter of good conduct from the police department. Then by definition, I'm not going to have good conduct.
Luis Santiago had his own thick file with the Puerto Rican cops. He co-founded a gay group around 1980, and before that was a member of a pro-independent student union until he got thrown out for officially proposing the group end discrimination against gays. He came to New York a couple years later to find a job, and in 1990 helped establish the Latino Caucus of ACT UP, a direct action group fighting AIDS. They pushed for information in Spanish and for important programs like the Needle Exchange.
There were some gay white men that came from a privileged background that the idea that they were in some way connected to the IV drug user in the Lower East Side was a little too far for them. The stretch was too big to cross. In general, I say the majority started crossing that that bridge. It was a learning process for them too. You know, I think they did learn that you know, in the end, you know, they're discriminated the same way we were discriminated. You know, they were ignored the same we were ignored.
Hispanic AIDS organizations had to learn the same lesson when it came to gay men.
They didn't really want to, you know, identify themselves so closely with the gay issues. They wouldn't go straight and talk, "Latino gay men, this is what's happening to you." But they would go like, you know, "There's an AIDS crisis, everybody's impacted. It doesn't matter who you are, what you do," and this ambiguity about it that reveal a fear of identifying too close with certain groups.
That fear looked a lot like hate during the 1992 fight over the rainbow curriculum. Designed to teach little kids of all races to respect each other, it was widely attacked because a few pages mentioned lesbians and gay men. Margarita Lopez had already worked 15 years on the Lower East Side when she stood up to defend the curriculum.
It was painful, that meeting. Very painful. Because I saw people who knew me, who knew that I fought for their child to get in the school that didn't exist, and the school was created. And I saw people that I worked with them to have the landlord allow them to continue to live in that apartment because the landlord was lying about that they didn't pay rent. And they have paid the rent. And we have the record. And I helped that to happen. And they did not get evicted. Then it was painful to see the same people not being honest enough about this issue and saying that they didn't want their children exposed to these ideas. But what was important for me about that was that I have the opportunity to make sure that people understood, look, I am a lesbian. The fact that I have been fighting your fights doesn't mean that I am going to hide what I am. And it's time for you to understand.
Gradually, they began to. Born in Brooklyn, Rosie Mendez witnessed the changes firsthand. She saw Margarita Lopez get elected to New York City Council as the first out and proud Latina lesbian and served for a few years as her chief of staff. Now the council member herself, Rosie describes being in Margarita's office one day when an elderly religious couple returned for a visit.
I remembered them. I said, oh, do you, did the problem come back? Or, you know, what problems do you have now? They go, no, just wanted to thank you. I wanted to thank you and Margarita because of you, we have, they're still holding their Bibles, so we have opened up our eyes a little bit more. Our grandson is gay. When he told his parents, my child, they beat him up and threw him out of the house. He came to us and we took him in. And he's living with us and he takes care of us. But it's because we met you and Margarita and you're here in the community that we weren't afraid of that. And we love him. He's our grandson. And I can only hope that my daughter will get to understand that one day.
This is Kelly Cogswell in New York.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Sarah Sweeney, Rick Watts, Abby Dees, and Wenzel Jones, Janet Mason, and Kelly Cogswell contributed program material. Thanks also to Cleve Jones and Steve Pride. Buena Vista performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Funding for this week's This Way Out came from the Gay Chemists Support Fund of the Horizons Foundation and from our generous listeners. Log on to thiswayout.org for program and podcast information, new CD offerings, and links to our blog and Facebook page. You can also find This Way Out on iTunes. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KHOI Ames, Iowa, 3MGB Malakuta, Victoria, WDFH Ossining, New York, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station.
And that's the truth.
Stay tuned.